This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights from 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our site at thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can listen to our past shows on our iPod Ready archives. That's thepeoplespeakradio.net. And for those who have Nokia phones, you can also listen to us live via satellite. Just go to the website for the details. It's a pleasure to have with us this evening what I consider to be a very important and influential and impressive woman. Nadia Hijab is the senior fellow of the Washington, D.C. based office of the Institute for Palestinian Studies. She is also co-director of its Washington, D.C. office. The Institute is an independent nonprofit research organization whose flagship Journal of Palestinian Studies, co-published with the University of California, is a leading resource in the Israeli-Arab conflict. You can go to this site by going to www.palestine-studies.org. Ms. Hijab is a frequent commentator in the media, including BBC World, and has appeared on the Lahir NewsHour. Her first book, Woman Power, The Arab Debate on Women at Work in 1988, was published by the Cambridge University Press. And she co-authored Citizens Apart, A Portrait of Palestinians in Israel. She was editor-in-chief in the London-based Middle East magazine before moving to New York in 1989 to join the United Nations, where she served as a senior development officer. She resigned from the UN in the year 2000 to establish her own consulting business, Development Analysis and Communication Services, DACS, on human rights, human development, and gender. She has served as co-chair of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation and is a past president of the Association of Arab American University Graduates. Wow, now that's a mouthful. I mean, it took me long enough just to say it, Nadia, and here we are talking to someone who's lived it. What an impressive resume you have. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. That's all very kind of you, Basma. Thanks for that very kind introduction.
Nadia, why is the Institute for Palestinian Studies started, and why is it so important?
Oh, well, thanks for asking that. It was started back in the early 60s, actually, and it's headquartered in Beirut. And it's important because it maintains the historical record. I mean, people tend to follow day-to-day news. Maybe they'll think 3 years back, 5 years back. Well, the Institute thinks 40 years back, 100 years back. And its journal, the Journal of Palestine Studies, which, as you said, is published with the University of California Press, has a diversity of voices, Palestinian, Arab, American, Israeli, European, from all over, sort of analyzing the issues, but also looking at the human perspective. I mean, it's an academic journal, but it's also a popular read. So they look at the human perspective. Recently, the journal carried a very important piece about archaeology in Gaza, something we don't normally think about when we think about Gaza, the effort to sort of preserve and rescue the archaeology and to establish a museum there. So it's full of interesting, topical, but also very, very well-documented, very substantial material.
Well, I know for myself, in a lot of my research, I've often turned to the Institute of Palestinian Studies for my own work. One of the things that I've found throughout the history of any of our publications, any of our institutes, any of our studies programs throughout the world is that they are often discredited. And I find that this institution itself has been one of the more credible ones. Do you have times when you feel that they are, again, trying to chip away at the credibility of any of your work there?
No, it's very hard to do so because the work is all extremely well documented, and that's why I'm very, I feel very privileged to be a fellow at the Institute and affiliated with it in this way. It's the journal is published with the University of California Press. It wouldn't be if there was anything in it that was not substantive or well documented. A lot of the books are co-published with the University of Columbia Press or other major publishing houses. And so, you know, it really is a very substantial organization. And the work, for example, it has the best book about the Palestinians before the diaspora, and it is in fact called Before the Diaspora, which has old photographs, a very succinct and very readable account of everything that happened before 1948, and, maps and chronologies. That's my favorite book. I often buy it and take it with me on my talks. I've been invited to speak at several synagogues, and I take a copy of that book along because some people disbelieve that there's such a thing as a Palestinian people. And this book shows, that the Palestinian people are not only very documented historically, but also there's visual documentation of schools, universities, towns, villages, churches, mosques. A very thriving culture was there prior to the establishment of the State of Israel.
If I'm not mistaken, I think I have a copy of that book in my library. I'm going to have to look it up. It was black and red, the cover was, in the original cover, wasn't it?
That's right, yes. Yes, I'm
yes,
glad you have a copy.
Yes, I do. And as a matter of fact, I received it many, many years ago when we were doing research as a young mother. We had a lot of, about 20% percentage of children, Arabic-speaking children, in the school that my children attended. And for whatever reasons that hatred tends to brew, we had a lot of bigotry and bias towards the Arab children there. And as one of the English-speaking Arabic mothers that had children in the school, I was often asked to come in and help out in translation. And we ended up doing a huge festival. It was one of the first of its kind. And this was, gosh, my son is 34, and he was 6 then when we did that. So we've been doing this work for a long, long time. And that was one of the books that I used to help educate some of the people that were there. It was a gift to me from a dear friend that has passed since then. Going back to the Institute, there's great value placed on the translation, and this I found to be very interesting. From Hebrew to Arabic in the Institute for Palestinian Studies. Why is that, Nadia? Why is that such a vital part of it?
Well, I mean, it's just very important to know, to understand, I think, the culture of the other. I mean, eventually that will stand in good stead when there's a sort of a just and comprehensive peace agreement. But in the meantime, people need to know what Israelis are thinking and what they're planning, for the future of the region. And I think it's very important to know what they're saying in their own. For example, you have the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which comes out both in English and in Hebrew. And there's a number of things that come out in Hebrew that simply don't make the English edition. And actually, the Institute, with the Israeli attacks on Lebanon in July 2006, began to again produce a digest of the Hebrew press translating from Hebrew to Arabic. Because, as I said, it's just very, very important for people to know what the Israelis are thinking. Now it's a time of war, and it's important to know what the Israelis are thinking. And eventually it'll be a time of peace, and it'll be important to know what the Israelis are thinking. And the Institute, actually, at its headquarters in Beirut, has the biggest collection of Hebraica in the region.
Very interesting, and I agree that it is absolutely necessary. I think we need a lot more transparency, especially coming from anything coming out of Israel, the state of Israel. I mean, it's kind of hard sometimes to glean between the propaganda and the truth and the reality. And they do have a rather interesting circumstance, I think, in Israel, in that I believe that their press is probably more free in what they say than what they say here in the United States.
Yes.
I find that to be interesting.
Yes, much more so. There's a much more lively debate about what's going on in Israel. Although there's also a lot of ignorance in Israel about what the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land is really like. You know, people, unless they serve in the military, they don't experience the occupation, and so there's a very small group of progressive Israelis who protest the occupation. The politicians, of course, stay on top of the issue, and they continue the settlement and colonization drive. But the mass of the people ignore it, and so although there's a very lively debate in the media, the mass of the people tend to ignore it, but it's not ignored in the rest of the world. It's harder to get information here in the States, but in Europe, for example, people are much better informed about what's going on in the occupied Palestinian territories.
You know, you recently wrote an article about Israel's new Kadima leader, Tzipi Livni, and the article portrayed a rather, well, unfortunately, and this is something that we're seeing a lot of, a rather dim view for peace, and your reasoning was very concise, and you cited three main reasons for this. Can you talk to us about some of these issues?
Yes, I felt that both the Israeli Labor Party and the Likud Party, i.e. both the right and the left on the Israeli establishment, have supported Israel's settlement enterprise, and the settlements have not stopped at any time during the peace process, even in the heyday of the peace process when the Israelis and the Palestinians were busily negotiating peace in 1993. The settlement construction was underway. In other words, Palestinians are losing land, they're losing water, they're losing their homes, they're losing their field, and they're being driven off their land. And that has continued without stop during 1993 to 1999, which were the years of the Oslo peace process, and they've continued since. And Ehud Olmert, who is, of course, the outgoing Israeli prime minister, recently gave an interview in which he said, a major interview in Yediot Aharonot, and he said, I am going to say things that no other Israeli leader has said. And he said, look, we're going to have to give back most of the West Bank and the Golan Heights and, you know, East, including East Jerusalem in the West Bank. And he said, we're just going to have to do this. But under Olmert's tenure, the pace of settlement construction actually increased from one year to the next. It doubled. And so the settlement movement has, as a result, got extremely strong. So that's one of my reasons that peace is now more difficult. It's not impossible to achieve on the basis of a two-state solution, but it is much more difficult because the settlement movement is so strong that it's going to take a very tough Israeli leader to rein it in, or a very tough U.S. leader to say to Israel, you have to rein it in and begin to freeze and then dismantle the settlements. And the settlers have not only been attacking Palestinians with their arms, they've also been attacking Israeli soldiers. And recently they put a pipe bomb outside the home of an Israeli Jewish, a very respected Israeli Jewish professor. Luckily he survived. But you know, it's a big irony that Israel has constructed this wall inside Palestinian land to keep the Palestinians away from Israel, but they cannot keep the settlers away from Israel, and the settlers are now attacking Israelis. So that's one major thing. Another major thing is that the Israeli political parties have, through their actions, because the Palestinian leadership has not been able to bring peace, the Palestinian leadership that sort of, if you like, worked on a platform of a two-state solution and peace with Israel is now greatly weakened, and Hamas is much, much stronger. so, but although I must say that Hamas also wants a two-state solution, so there's not a huge difference in those terms. But the Palestinian leadership is very weakened at the moment. So and that's important because the Palestinian leadership convinced the Palestinians to make a huge compromise and accept just 22% of Mandate Palestine instead of being able to have their homes in all of Palestine. So, but the Palestinian leadership may be called upon to try and get another compromise as to the right of return. Well, it doesn't have the authority to do so because it just doesn't, have credibility, as much credibility today as Arafat, for example, the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat had with the Palestinian people. And finally, the United States has insisted on monopolizing the brokering of peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and yet it's done nothing. So you have a lot of niceties. You have Rice coming on visits to the region. You have meetings between President Bush and Palestinian leaders, and it all leads to nothing. I mean, nothing changes on the ground. There's no freedom of movement for Palestinians. They're still losing their land and water to Israeli settlers. There's still about 10,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails. And the U.S. is unwilling or unable to do anything to bring about peace, and it doesn't let anybody else do so, so it doesn't let the Europeans do so. So that's why peace isn't looking very positive at the moment.
Let me ask you, how do you think the European and the Russians can actually shed new light in this area if they were allowed to engage in the process, that is?
Well, I mean, they wouldn't even have to be allowed to engage, especially the Europeans. The Europeans have a trade agreement. The European Union has a trade agreement with mm-hmm. Israel. And Article 2 of European Union trade agreements, Article 2 speaks about upholding human rights and, you know, not dealing as normal with countries that violate human rights. And the EU is Israel's most important trading partner, so it could easily take a stand vis-a-vis Israel and say, look, you know, we want to trade with you, we 100% believe in Israel's security, but you're going to have to pull out of the West Bank, otherwise there are going to be some consequences here. And they could easily do that. Now, one thing is that with the financial crisis, the global financial crisis that people rightly place at the responsibility for at the doorstep of the United States. With the global financial crisis, I think the U.S. is very politically weakened, not only economically weakened, and so it may not be able to order people around or countries around in the way it used to. So we may see the Europeans in the not-too-distant future becoming more willing to play a role for peace. And, you know, as the settler movement gets more and more out of hand, if I were a European leader, I would be a bit apprehensive, because what if the settlers, they're now very strong in the army as a movement, they have a lot of soldiers and officers in the army. What if they eventually take over government and Israel has, you know, anywhere between 200 and 400 nuclear warheads? It would be a very frightening thing for the Europeans who live right next door. So we may see some more movement in that direction.
Well, I certainly think that many Palestinians originally had often said that the destruction of Israel would probably not come from outside. It would come from within at the hands of the settlers, this nation of people that they have brought in and imported from other countries. Are savagely attaching themselves to many aspects of Israel, and thus far it has not been a good scenario. So I don't know. I tend to agree with you that it certainly is going to be a major problem, and it is considered a major problem. I think that very little light is actually shed on it at this point. The impression was for us here in the United States, Nadia, was that the Bush administration would be heralding in a peace agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians before his term ends. And for those of you that are interested in talking to Nadia, Nadia Hijab of the Palestinian Institute of Studies. We will be at 1-877-489-6350, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. Again, the numbers are 877-489-6350 and 888-228-4494. We'll also be taking questions via text and email, so for those of you that are interested, please let us know, and we will forward your questions to Nadia. But again, back to the Bush administration. Obviously, in light of all of the economic hoopla that has really just crushed the economy at this point, and we're kind of bruised and battered, will anybody even remember the Israeli-Palestine issue from now till the demise of this current administration, Nadia?
Oh, no. I mean, I think it's very far down on people's radar screen for now. But, you know, I think it will come back up when, I mean, this isn't a part of the world in which America is intensely engaged, you know, through the war in Iraq, through the war in Afghanistan, and in terms of, and obviously through the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And there's been sort of report after report and study after study that you cannot solve any of the problems of the Middle East without tackling the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and settling that. And so while everything is kind of on the back burner until the economic crisis is addressed, this problem won't stay on the back burner for long. And let's not forget that the U.S. Sends about $3 billion of aid to Israel, and aid, that kind of aid, is one of the things that will come into question as the U.S. tries to balance its books, which it has to start doing pretty pretty soon. Otherwise, you know, a lot of people, for now, there is still confidence in the U.S. economy. But if, you know, the deficit continues, and then the confidence will dissipate, and then it'll be very bad news.
Certainly diminished, that's for sure. I'll tell you, one of the things that I've often said, and when I many times do my own writing, I consider the peace process to be more war. And because as long as we are in a process of achieving peace, we do not have peace. All we have is the status quo, which is war. And it's uncomfortable. It's disheartening. And it certainly throws a wedge in every campaign promise that we as Arab Americans or Palestinians in this country hear. The Obama and McCain debates have shown that any new leadership in this country offer no new practices on the issue of peace talks. In fact, I think you wrote an article and you cited the issue of the Embassy Act of 1995. Can you explain to our listeners what the Embassy Act was and how it relates to the United States and peace in our country?
Well, I mean, there's been, Congress has had passed a resolution that the U.S. should move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The thing is that Jerusalem, the Israeli annexation of Arab East Jerusalem, is not recognized. It's illegal against it. It's illegal under international law, and it's not recognized by any country in the world, really. There used to be a couple of small countries that recognized it, and they don't anymore. But if the U.S. were to move its embassy, then that would convey legal status on Jerusalem and on Israel's annexation. And that would lead to a lot of it would lead to a big global upset, actually, in the Arab and the Muslim world, if that should happen. So it will worsen relations it will really harm relations to a great extent, and create a lot of problems for the U.S. and the region. And candidates keep promising to move the embassy, but then when the president gets into office, he kind of usually stops the embassy move, but I don't know what would happen with the new candidates at this time.
I wonder, what is the process of actually moving an embassy from one place to another? I mean, I would. Is it something that can be done at the behest of a presidency, or is that something that has to be officially voted on in Congress or the Senate? I mean, are there any parameters for moving an embassy?
Congress has already voted on it. But the
president has.
Congress has voted in favor of doing that. But the president has stopped it. You know, it has come to the president's desk and he hasn't signed on it. And this applies to President, you know, Clinton, it applies to President Bush, because it would just be too much for the Arab and Muslim world to take, or the rest of the world, really, because it's such a flagrant violation of international law. I mean, the tragedy really here, Basma, is that the Arabs have been calling for peace with Israel. I mean, everybody is, all Arab leaders, including Palestinian leaders, are now very ready to recognize Israel within the 67 borders, have two states, have a Israeli capital in East in Jerusalem and the Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, and to come to an agreed upon just resolution for the Palestinian refugees. And the only thing is that this is not being implemented, but you have so much of the world behind the solution, and Israel pays lip service to it, and so does the United States, but then nothing gets done. And all the people who are suffering at the moment, you know, don't need to be suffering, because we have a solution if people wanted to implement it. Now, if this solution, if things change and people cannot implement, can no longer implement a two-state solution, I think we're just going to see a lot of chaos and bloodshed within the Israeli-Palestinian scene here.
I have to agree that I think a lot more violence is coming, and it's really quite distressing to people that have been working for peace for I guess I didn't realize how long I'd been doing this, probably about 30 years now. So we do have some questions here for you, Nadia. Omar in the United Kingdom is asking, now that we know Obama is the next most likely president, will anything change in this respect regarding U.S. policies to Israel and Palestine?
Well, I wouldn't be too sure that Obama is the next president yet, but if he is the next president, I think you will see a difference in tone and in approach between Obama and McCain, in any case, on dealing with the rest of the world, including with Israel-Palestine. Now, Obama has, of course, spoken out very, very strongly about his support for Israel. Mm-hmm. Before he started running full steam ahead for the presidency, he has knowledge about what's going on in the occupied territories, and he expressed sympathy for the plight of the Palestinians. So and by the way, McCain also has expressed some pragmatism. For example, when Hamas was elected, McCain said, well, we may not like it, but we have to deal with them. So, you know, both candidates, I think, are knowledgeable about the Middle East, and the Arab-Israeli conflict, a bit more, much more knowledgeable than, for example, Bush, the present president. Obama also said...
I'm sorry, I almost laugh when you say that.
Yeah.
Because I can't see Bush as being knowledgeable about very much of anything. But go
well,
on, I'm sorry.
You, I said they are much more knowledgeable than him.
This is true. It would certainly be refreshing to have anybody else in office at this point, but go ahead. I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting you.
I am hoping for Obama, because I think it would be a lot better for the United States and
absolutely
and for the rest of the world. So, but the point is here, Obama has said that he will engage on the Middle East crisis immediately, and you know, he won't let it go, the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. He said he will move immediately. The question is, how will he move, and who will be his advisors? When he visited Israel, one of the people that reportedly went and helped set up his meetings with Israel is a former U.S. peace negotiator called Dennis Ross. And he's done more than anyone, I think, during the Oslo peace process, Dennis Ross, to let the settlements happen without any sort of stand by the United States, without a firm stand. I mean, so on the Ross watch, settlements happily increased without the U.S. taking any kind of position. So if Ross is going to be his advisor, then we're in for more of the same. If he gets a different set of advisors, or if he starts to implement some of the peace proposals that are already up there, then we might see a difference.
Yeah, I agree. We have another question from Bobby. Let me get that. And Bobby, in the United States of America, would you compare what Israel is doing in the West Bank and Golan Heights and occupied Shebha Farms equal to the U.S. and U.K. and other allied countries building cities in Iraq and resettling Americans in Iraq permanently? I think he's comparing the two and wondering what your thoughts are on the comparison.
I wouldn't quite. I mean, that's a very interesting question. I wouldn't quite compare them. I think the situations are somewhat different. Israel is occupying the Palestinian land with a view to becoming the sole sort of inhabitant in that land, and it has a variety of measures in place to keep Palestinians out of the territories. I mean, for example, it's very difficult for Palestinians to even visit now. Americans of Palestinian heritage or other Americans find it very hard to visit the Palestinian territories in the West Bank and in Gaza now and in East Jerusalem. Palestinian families find it very hard to reunify with their spouses, to get the right of residence there. So Israel is not only taking the land, it's actually emptying the land from its people. So that's kind of, let's say, a colonialist enterprise of a kind that's very unique almost, because you really want to keep the land and all its resources and get rid of the people. What's going on in Iraq is more like an economic colonialism, if you like, so that there is control of Iraq's oil resources, but not necessarily kicking Iraqis off their land and replacing them with other inhabitants.
Well, I agree that it certainly is. There are some similarities, but again, I think the intention behind the occupation, as you put it, I think is far removed from what's happening in Iraq. What does Joe Biden mean to the Palestinian peace process?
Well, you know, he said, he referred to himself as a Zionist, and he said that you don't have to be Jewish to be Zionist. I mean, he's extremely pro-Israel. His record, his voting record is very pro-Israel. I mean, all their voting records are pro-Israel, really, the majority of Congress at the moment. And this will not change until and unless the American people ask for a different approach from their leaders. I mean, that's what needs to happen. At the moment, the loudest voice calling the shots on what the American leaders should do is the Zionist lobby, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. So neither Biden nor Obama nor McCain nor anybody else is going to do different so long as there's not a strong enough counter-movement in the offing. Now, what's one of a slight tidbit about Joe Biden is that he was actually one of the election observers when the Palestinian elections were held. So he has been out there.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that Joe Biden was one of them.
Yes, I mean, you know, Jimmy Carter and a lot of people went out when the Palestinian elections took place to observe that they were free and fair elections, which they were. So, again, he is, I think, knowledgeable about the region, but he will not take a stand that will upset AIPAC. unless the American people demand it. And what I think is interesting here is that there is a shift amongst several groups on the U.S. Political scene. There are a number of American Jewish groups that have now formed at the center of the political spectrum, and they are saying it is possible to be pro-peace and pro-Israel, and they are saying that they speak with a different voice than the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And the most recent group to be established and to join that little constellation there in the center is something called J Street, which has set itself to be a lobby that is pro-Israel, but that takes a very different stand from AIPAC. So that's very interesting. And then, so that's in the center. On the left of the political spectrum, there are a number of churches that are taking a stand to say, if the occupation is wrong, we should not be investing our resources, i.e. our pension plans, should not invest in companies that support the occupation, companies like Caterpillar, whose bulldozers Israel uses to bulldoze Palestinian homes, or Motorola, which has established a number of military and intelligence infrastructures in the occupied territories. And so these churches, and we're talking mainstream churches here, like the United Methodists or the Presbyterians, are beginning to look at divestment options, and they are part of a growing grassroots movement in the United States that's kind of grouped in the coalition, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Again, that is a different and growing voice. And together, these voices may get stronger over time and may be able to challenge, you know, AIPAC and demand a different approach from the leadership.
Well, while we're on that question, there are a couple of other questions, but this one is pertaining to J Street. Angela in Louisiana asks, what does Nadia think of J Street? Does she see anything positive coming from them? And do they have a chance against AIPAC?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I do see something positive coming because they will broaden the framework of debate. They will change, they will contribute to changing the discourse. And you know, the changing the discourse is actually very, very important. And if you have different voices saying, look, you know, AIPAC says that you have to, for example, cut off aid to the Palestinians to punish them. But others who are also Americans, who are also American Jews, you know, are saying differently, then you have to sit up and take notice. Or let's say AIPAC is allied with the Christian Zionists that have recently set up a large organization called Christians United for Israel, and they don't want to see any of the land being given back in a two-state solution. So, but J Street thinks differently. J Street thinks that, you know, the best thing for Israel is a two-state solution where Palestinians are, you know, guaranteed human rights. So there is a major difference in opinion. There's another group that's actually joined this constellation, the center, which is B'Tselem, which is the Israeli Human Rights Organization. They've recently opened an office in Washington. And again, they will change the discourse. And I think it's really important for people to be speaking at different parts of the political spectrum to challenge the existing discourse. And J Street will be doing that in the center. And other groups will be doing that, you know, on the left.
Very interesting, yeah. Omar in UAE, given the fact that 100,000-plus settlements, and he says in parentheses, correct me if I'm wrong, and 450,000 settlers in the West Bank, is there really any chance of establishing a Palestinian state in internationally agreed-upon occupied Palestinian territories?
Yes, I mean, you know, the settlers, of course, as I'm sure Omar knows, and as everybody knows, the settlements are illegal, so they should all be dismantled and gone home. And we have an example of settlements being dismantled in Gaza in 2005. This does not this did not lead to peace because it wasn't followed by anything in the West Bank. On the contrary, colonization in the West Bank increased. And the siege around Gaza tightened so that Gazans are not able to get in and out and are living in horrendous conditions of malnutrition and illiteracy and disease. And people are dying simply because they cannot get out to get the treatment that they need. Now, if there is to be a two-state solution, it would be possible to move enough of the settlements away from enough of the West Bank, to have that solution. But if the settlement movement grows even stronger than it is today, then it will make that solution impossible. And a number of Palestinians are beginning to say that, you know, the two-state solution is impossible. We need to be working for civil rights within Israel, within one state. We need to say to Israel, okay, you know, you're ruling over us. We demand equal rights within the states, and we don't want to express our self-determination anymore through a separate, independent Palestinian state.
Mm. Mm. Very interesting. We have a question from Mike in California, and he asks, have you ever thought of the occupation of Tibet in comparison to the occupation of Palestine, and if there could be lessons learned or strategies shared between the two oppressed people, especially in regard to the Dalai Lama reaching out to Palestine?
That's a very interesting question. And I think the situation in Palestine is different because China is so powerful. I mean, in many ways, even more powerful than Israel, that hard though it is to believe, I think less attention internationally is paid, you know, more attention internationally is paid to the Palestinians. They have more access a bit more access to the media. And Tibet is in some respects, Tibet has more support, let's say, in a lot of among a lot of sort of lead figures, and many people do support it, but I don't know. I mean, I would think that the Palestinians have more sources of power at their disposal than the Tibetans. That would be my take on it.
Well, obviously, the nation of China is going to wield a heavier blow than Israel, but just because of the sheer numbers, I think, if nothing else. So I agree. We have a caller on the line, Nadia. And caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? And what is your question for Nadia? Hello? I guess our caller went AWOL.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes. My comment earlier was misunderstood. When I talked about the settlements, I was referring to the legality of the settlements period under the Geneva Convention. It does not allow for, it would not allow for England and the United States to settle people from the United States and England and build cities in occupied Iraq, not now and not in 40 years, and annex parts of Iraq and say this is part of England and Canada, or meaning England and the United States. And the settlements in the West Bank should be viewed in those terms as an illegal expansion under occupation. The Geneva War Convention banned the practice completely. So not one settler must be allowed in the West Bank, and not one house settlement must be allowed in the West Bank under no circumstances, because it would set precedents. And then we have recreation of the colonialism under Geneva Convention, and we'll be creating countries like South Africa, apartheid South Africa, and those again and again and again. So we go back to the old mistake. That's what I meant by my original comment. What I want to talk about is this. The Palestinian study center or and research. What do you think? Why would you think that Israel is actually capable as a government and as a society of continuing the peace process? I used to be a believer of peace process, and now I understand Israel so well that I know they are incapable. Even if the leaders want it, they wouldn't do it for the simple reason. If the peace process happens, Israel will convert its war with the Arabs to internal war. And in an internal war, the West will be divided and confused which side to support. But when they are at war with the Arabs, they will support all Israelis against the Arabs. So I myself, personally, do not believe the peace process is possible or probable. And this is all more buying time for Israel to continue the destruction and the attrition of the Palestinian people, where it, at one point it would be impossible for Palestinians to continue to survive in the West Bank or Gaza. And if they exist, they would exist in ghettos that has no rights, and they would start the civil rights movement of the, having rights in within the state of Israel in 50 years.
Thank you. Thank you, caller. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nadia, do you have any comments on any of what our caller's statements were?
Sure. First of all, I couldn't agree more that all the settlements are illegal under international law. I mean, that's international law is very clear on that. And I think it's very, very important that the International Court of Justice, when it was asked to give an advisory opinion on the wall that Israel is building within the occupied territories and well into the West Bank, reaffirmed the illegality of the wall and its associated regime of, you know, and all the destruction of Palestinian homes and lands involved in the building of the wall, and said that Israel should pay compensation for that, which is a very interesting legal opinion to be put out there, that Israel should be actually paying the Palestinians compensations for the damage that they experienced during the occupation. And the International Court of Justice called on all world countries not to assist Israel in the construction of this wall, which of course, you know, by extension applies to any assistance that's given to Israel in its occupation of Palestinian land. So Israel's legal situation is completely untenable in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, to say nothing of its moral situation. I want to clarify that I am speaking as in my capacity as a senior fellow. I do not represent the Institute for Palestine Studies, so I'm not representing any kind of position of the Institute for Palestine Studies. Also, I want to clarify that the Institute doesn't take positions. It is a research and publishing center, and it provides studies and the documents and research that if there are any positions are the positions of the authors, and it provides a diversity of views on the issues. I just wanted to clarify that. I do think that I agree with the caller that Israel is on kind of on automatic pilot. I mean, it does continue to colonize, even as, for example, somebody like Ehud Olmert says, we have to give it up. He doubles the pace of settlement construction. So in a sense, they're locked into this colonial enterprise and finding it impossible to get out of it. And if they don't get out of it, then it will turn into a civil a struggle for civil rights within Israel, and that is something that scares them very much. So, you know, I think Israel, for all its power on the ground, in many ways is stuck.
Nadia, you know, I think for me, what I one of the things that I find so interesting is that when the leaders of this Israeli nation come to the end of their terms or the end of their administrations, no matter how they come to that, suddenly want peace for Palestine and Israel. Yet during the entire tenure of their reign, and I'm going to say their occupational reign. Peace is never brought up. It was Sharon, just before he left, became this virtuoso of the peace process, and Olmert, after, you know, raining terror on Gaza, raining terror on Lebanon, suddenly wanted peace for the Palestinians. Do you think that this is just some kind of a guise that that the leaders use in order that they don't leave with this bad taste in their mouth, like, here we are, Israel, Israeli leaders, we want to make peace with the Palestinian kind of scenario?
Sure, they pay a lot of lip service to peace, but, I mean, I think in terms of sincerity, my God, Sharon, I mean, you know, he never once wanted, he's done more than anyone to try and destroy the Palestinian national movement. He invaded Lebanon back in 1982 in order to destroy the Palestine Liberation Organization, even though the PLO had maintained a ceasefire for about 9 months, unofficial ceasefire with Israel for about 9 months. And Sharon, I mean, has done everything possible to he kept Arafat under siege in his compound, probably leading to his death, my God, I mean, you could just talk for a whole hour about what Sharon has done to crush the Palestinians and, you know, have complete Israeli control over the entirety of Mandate Palestine. I mean, Sharon was also very fond of saying that actually Jordan is Palestine. If the Palestinians want to have a national identity, they should go express it in Jordan. I wouldn't say that Sharon paid too much of a lip service to peace, but Olmert is interesting because he's so obviously, he understands what's going to happen to Israel if it doesn't have peace. He said that if Israel doesn't have a two-state solution with the Palestinians, they will go for civil rights, and then Israel will be tarred as an apartheid state throughout the world. I mean, everybody will say, look, there's dual system in Israel, one for the Israelis, one for the Palestinians, and that the Israelis should have peace for that purpose. But, as I said, you know, at the same time, he could not stop settling Palestinian land. So I think the Israelis are stuck. I want to say one thing here, which is about the 1.2 million Palestinian citizens of Israel who are now beginning to fight for equal rights for the Palestinian citizens of Israel. They have some rights as Israelis, Israeli passport holders, but they don't have the full range of rights that Israeli Jews have, and they are beginning a quite strong movement of civil struggle, and that's in a sense very challenging for Israel because it has to become someday the state of all its citizens. It cannot continue to have one regime for Palestinian Israelis and another regime for Israeli Jews. So there's a challenge right there, even if you put to one side the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem.
Yeah, absolutely. We have one more question here that I'd like to get in before the end of our time, but I do have to make a comment that I had to laugh when I was reading your article about the hindrances that are still ongoing in Palestine. And you said that Livni was one of the rare breed of Israeli leaders that was actually allowed to travel because she didn't. There wasn't a threat of her being arrested for war crimes somewhere in the world. And I read that, and I just thought, oh, my God, that is so true. What an interesting concept that is, that there is actually a leader that isn't a war criminal in Israel. I had to throw that out. I mean, it was just too good to pass up. Nadia, thank you for that. Yeah. Alan, Minnesota, is there a conspiracy of Zionist-influenced and led groups in the U.S. that control political and foreign policy towards Palestine in favor of Israel? And if so, what can be done to make Americans aware of this bias and injustice?
You know, I don't, and that's an interesting question. I just would, I don't personally like to use the word conspiracy because conspiracy indicates that, you know, there's something happening underground behind closed doors and so on. And actually the reality is that there's a very strong, Zionist lobby here in the United States. They call themselves pro-Israel. They are actually pro-Israel's occupation and pro the Israeli right. And most of what they do is there in the public sphere, you know, for everybody to see. They have their annual conference, you know, there's several hundreds of organizations and groups. And, you know, their directories listing them and their activities are there in the public sphere. And they're very strong and they're very organized because they work on this issue all the time. And by contrast, the other side, if you like, or the voice that the different voices that there are not as organized and don't work on this issue all the time. And I'm very glad you brought the question of what can we do. And I think people who believe in peace with justice need to organize better and make their voices heard more strongly. And one of the reasons that, well, although I'm pessimistic in the short term, I'm optimistic in the longer term, is that people are beginning to do that. As I said, amongst the American Jewish groups, there are a number of movements that are challenging the Zionist right, and also amongst many American groups, there's a challenge to the whole concept that of colonization of Palestinian land, and that is extremely supportive of Palestinian human rights. And that includes churches, it includes Arab American, it includes Black Americans, it includes American Jews, it includes Americans from all walks of life and all shades and shapes and colors and faith. And so I think if people do believe with peace and justice, they need to get out there and do the work and get the money together to do the work. That is all that the Zionist movements are doing in this country.
Yeah, I agree with you, you know, and it would be unfortunate for us to consider it a secret conspiracy when it's quite obvious and quite in our faces, and I don't think there's any secrecy or underground movement about it. They are right there, and they are doing what they need to do to procure a greater foothold in the Middle East for Israel. You know, this has been a great pleasure, Nedia. We could talk about this topic for hours and hours. You are so informed, and it's been a pleasure. Perhaps we can have you back one day because, really, this is very important. And I think a lot of people struggle for answers from Palestinian speakers so that they can know more about what's happening. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me, and good luck.
Thank you. Please join us on Monday with Charlie Giuliani, Tuesdays with myself, Basma Farhat, and Wednesday with David Swanson. Monday we have Nadir, a musician and activist. On Wednesday we have Gary Spence, a super lawyer of the Silkwood case, infamy. Thank you very much, and it has been a pleasure. Everyone have a great night.
Goodbye.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us, but for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease,